Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, we hear from a filmmaker who made a documentary about living with dwarfism. Then, musicians and poets plan to celebrate the late Paul Robeson in Oakland, and a film questions if technology and money should outweigh the arts and community. This show asks the question, what's really going on? That's all coming up next. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton. When you first meet Bay Area filmmaker Julie Wyman, you might not consider her as someone living with dwarfism because she's 5 feet tall. Or maybe you would because the proportions on her body are not considered quote-unquote average. But there's no one type of dwarfism. There are actually more than 400 forms of dwarfism, and that's according to the organization Little People of America. As a child, Julie was teased about her body, but she later found support when attending a Little People of America conference, and she tells her story in the documentary The Tallest Dwarf. It's screening during the San Francisco International Film Festival, and you can watch it this weekend on April 26th at the Premier Theater in San Francisco and on April 27th at BAMFA in Berkeley. I spoke with Julie Wyman about her film and seeing the beauty in dwarfism and disability. Julie Wyman, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I am so happy to talk to you and to talk about this amazing film. It's so layered. It's so layered. It looks at dwarfism, you know, just from these different angles. And you're a person that people may look at and not necessarily think of a dwarf. So for listeners, can you describe what it is about your body that makes you fall into that category?
Yeah, thank you. I am, for a long time, would say I'm not a dwarf, or that I'm dwarfish. I have short arms and legs. I'm 5 feet tall, so I'm in the realm of average height, although on the short side of that. And I have shorter arms and legs, and the shape of my thighs and I think it's my femur bone, the upper arm and the upper leg are shorter, so that my thighs and upper arms are quite like thick. Like I have a big butt and big calves. So my legs are kind of thick and short. And my torso is quite long. Like if I'm sitting, I mean, it's average size. So if I'm sitting next to anyone who's 6'5" or extremely tall, we look eye to eye at each other. But then when we stand up, I'm looking at their chest or below.
Okay.
So my proportions are different. And it's a subtle thing that some people might completely miss, and yet other people really notice. And as a kid, I got bullied. I got called all kinds of, you know, names that little people get called. I got called Oompa Loompa and what we call the M word, midget, which is a bad word in, you know, LP, dwarf culture. You know,
LP is little people.
Little people is our preferred term. You know, some people claim the word dwarf, and a lot of people talk about dwarfism. I do claim the word dwarf, dwarf identity, dwarf pride.
I just want to go back as far as about, you know, your body proportions. And so you inherited that from your father.
I have a mutation that's a form of dwarfism called hypochondroplasia. And I did inherit that from my father. My aunt, his sister, had the same thing. And so did their mother, my grandmother.
Okay. And so I just learned so much in this film. And it was a lovely film, too, as well. You know, because when we see little people in television, you know, often in media, it's dehumanization. So, you know, it was refreshing to see little people humanized, right? And to see the range of little people culture and sizes and experiences. What made you want to create this film? Is something, you know, aside from your background, was there something, a catalyst that you were like, I got to do this?
Yeah, I had made some other films that are also about people who don't fit, whose bodies are different. I made a film about a troupe of fat synchronized swimmers called the Padded Lilies. and them going on the Jay Leno Tonight Show. I want to make space on screen for us to see each other in a different way, to see each other's beauty and power. And that's because of the experience I've had in my body, feeling different and shunned for that difference, and then over many years coming to a sense of ownership and pride.
And I want to mention briefly, when I was reading your bio, that someone who inspired you to be a filmmaker, who doesn't get their props like they deserve, is the late Marlon Riggs, who made the documentary Tongues Untied. And he's a Black gay man, you know, and he inspires so many artists in the Bay Area and beyond. So I was like, when I saw that, I was like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah, I saw Tongues Untied when I was in college, and I wasn't even in the Bay Area at the time. But I had heard of the film because, you know, it was a big controversy. You know, it was a controversy in terms of NEA funding, you know, interesting to think about that right now. And the poetry, the varied tone, and the just beauty of Tongues Untied, like, called me. And I was like, if that is film, I want to make film.
And Tongues Untied, was that only about Black gay men, or was it about Black gay people in general? It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Yeah, Tongues Untied is about Black gay male identity. And it's kind of about, it's not just about Marlon Riggs, it's about his community of artists and poets.
Right.
But it's kind of about the way that within civil rights, there's a lot of homophobia. And within the gay movement, it was, you know, quite like white, like, you know, the gay, especially, you know, when you go to clubs and see, you know, the sort of gay beauty aesthetic at the time, it was one way. It was like this one muscle man who was white, you know? And so Marlon Riggs was asking, where am I? You know, I fall between these identities and there's no place for me in either one. The way that film articulates being in between, I think really spoke to my way of being like dwarf-ish, you know, and sort of having something that didn't quite fit in one camp or another exactly.
And so let's actually jump into that, because that was my next question about you navigating the in-between. Your proportions put you in as far as being not average, and then your height, you're not average with little people. So talk about this, the navigating of in between within the little people community.
Right. I mean, walking into LPA was an incredible and like electric experience. I definitely felt like I didn't fit. I was taller than everyone. I'd never been in a room of little people, a whole hotel lobby. I felt two things very strongly, that I didn't fit and that I did fit. Like, I was looking around and seeing bodies that looked like mine and looked like my dad's and my aunt's and my grandma's. And as I got to know the community, you know, at first I came in sort of as a filmmaker and I thought that was the way to enter. I thought, you know, oh, I have an excuse. I want to make a film and I can also find out about myself and if I fit. And as I started explaining to people there, well, my grandma and my dad also have this body type, and I think it might be a form of dwarfism. Then I was like welcomed in, because the experience of being undiagnosed is quite common in little people community. A lot of people get the wrong diagnosis or no diagnosis, especially in my generation or older.
Gen X. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with filmmaker Julie Wyman about her documentary, The Tallest Dwarf, and you can see it on April 26th at the Premier Theater in San Francisco and on April 27th at BAMFA in Berkeley. Julie, you know, I noticed in the film, the art within the art of the film, there's I love poetry, I'm a poet, so there's poetry, but I was really struck by the dancing in this work.
Yeah, I think one of the goals is to kind of create a new form of beauty and to show our bodies together, moving in sync, and in a way that feels liberating to us. And so what we're seeing is people finding that and us finding it together and being a group of people with very varied proportions, lots of forms of dwarfism, but moving, following each other in movement. And that felt like a real reclaiming of the space of dance. I and Sophia, my main collaborator in the workshop space, really wanted to welcome people in physically and for the film to kind of show our joy and our connection in physically being together.
I love those scenes. I want to talk about the medical industry, because that's definitely a huge issue that's mentioned in the film. And so I was surprised because, again, this is not something I'm familiar with. There was a scene with Mark, one of the people in the film, Mark, and he mentioned there was a discussion about, like, that, you know, LPA is going to look different in the future. And he mentioned that there's new pharmaceutical drugs coming out that basically, and I'm reading too from the press release that you sent, that targets the gene mutation that results in slower bone growth. So there's people who are, looking at having their children, you know, use this type of pharmaceutical drugs to make them taller. And on the flip side, you have people, you know, in the LP community saying, we're fine the way we are. We don't need to be taller. And then you have parents, and I'm sure some adults in the LP community saying, like, you know, but life will be easier. I'll have more access to things. I won't experience as much discrimination. And your mom didn't want you to be on growth hormones, because your doctor pitched that to you when you were younger. So what is going on?
What's going on is that there's a big, deep yearning in our world to fit in, whether that's, you know, fit into average size clothing, chairs, can reach faucets and light fixtures. And that yearning has fueled science and medicine to try to find ways to make people who are shorter taller throughout human history, actually. You know, so I was trying to look at these new pharmaceutical gene therapies, and I realized I needed to connect them to a longer history of growth hormone treatment and research that actually has been really centered in the Bay Area. So, I mean, it's been all over the world, but especially the Bay Area has been a ground zero for that. The interesting thing is that the new pharmaceutical treatments may help reduce medical complications, and that's the hope. You know, some people with dwarfism, not all, but some have to go through a lot of surgeries or other difficult, serious medical complications. And there's a hope that maybe these treatments will help that. The research, the clinical trials for these treatments only measured height. Do these drugs make people grow more and faster? So even though there's sort of a hope that maybe this will help complications, that isn't what was tested. So at the time that I was making this film and researching it, there's a feeling, and rightly so, I think, within the little people community that if this is about height, we don't need height. You know, we may want help with our other medical complications, like sleep apnea, foramen magnum compression, and several others I could list, but we don't want to be taller. There's nothing wrong with our height. The treatments that are on the market now do require parental proxy consent. Like they are effective in infancy and early childhood. So kids won't be able to decide for themselves if they're given this medication. 80% of little people are born to average height parents, and they really feel the tough burden. What if I should give the medicine and I don't? What if I don't give the medicine and I shouldn't have? And so they're in a tough position. And I know this is all a lot, but the way it kind of made sense in my film is thinking about how are we seen, and how is medicine one of the outside gazes that has... And how is medicine part of and the core of the medical model of disability, which wants to solve the problem of being different by changing the individual to fit society, as opposed to the social model, which is about changing society, changing our social built world to welcome and include all bodies.
Yeah. There was a scene in the film, and you mentioned her name, the one who was teaching the dance class.
Sophia.
And she said, I love my life. And so I'm hearing what you're saying as far as like, hey, you know, how some people, not, and I know it's not everybody, but how some people feel like, yeah, help me sleep better. You know, maybe have something to help with pain or whatever. But there's people saying like, I love my, because, you know, y'all look tight. The people look tight.
Yeah. I want the film to really uphold this thing that's really real, which is a sense of dwarf pride and dwarf identity, and the sense of like, hey, we are beautiful and we are bringing our, you know, physique and also our perspectives and knowledge from living in this world, in this form, to this world, you know, and it might be easier if everyone was the same, but how boring would our world be, you know? And so for us as little people and for the little people I encounter, that's the kind of joy that I wanted to show, is like, we're good, you know, we like who we are. I mean, yes, for some people there can be medical complications, but it's not about being taller isn't the cure to what ails us. You know, we don't suffer. And one poet says, I don't suffer from my dwarfism. I suffer from the way the world sees dwarfism.
Julie Wyman, thank you so much for your time and for making this film. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and for your great questions.
That was Julie Wyman, Associate Professor of Cinema and Digital Media at UC Davis. Her film, The Tallest Dwarf, is screening during the San Francisco International Film Festival, and you can see it at the Premier Theater in San Francisco and on Sunday at BAMFA in Berkeley. Coming up, a poetry and jazz celebration for the late activist and artist Paul Robeson. Keep it locked right here.
Must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along.
You're listening to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. That audio you just heard is a clip of Paul Robeson singing Old Man River from the film Showboat. I wanted you to hear Robeson's beautiful signature baritone voice. Robeson was also an actor, a college football player, a scholar, a law school graduate, and an activist. And this month marks his 127th birthday. The Poetry and Jazz Ensemble Upsurge NYC is putting on a celebration of Robeson this Saturday in Oakland at the Plymouth Church of Jazz and Justice. And here to talk more about this event and Paul Robeson's legacy is Raymond Nat Turner. He is Upsurge's artistic director and a poet, a great poet who I've had the privilege of seeing perform for Maya Angelou celebration a few months ago. So, Raymond, tell us, what is Upsurge?
Well, Upsurge is a jazz poetry ensemble that I founded October 28th of 1990, officially. And it was our first gig was at the Coffee Mill in Oakland, which is Oakland's oldest coffee house. And at that particular time, I was relying on the what I dubbed the Jazz Factory, Berkeley High's phenomenal jazz program. So I had young high school musicians that were very incredible musicians, and what happened, they got an opportunity to learn to play out before audiences and to be responsible for making their gigs and everything, and you know, working in a different medium and all that, and I benefited from having this youthful exuberance, this youthful energy. And so we did that for about 5 years, and then transition to, you know, some of the Bay Area's best resident artists, resident musicians, and from there on, you know, we did festivals, yeah, like the Monterey Jazz Festival, the Panafest Festival in Ghana, you know, West Africa.
And now you know you're in New York now, but like I said again, I saw you perform in San Francisco recently. So you do come back and forth. You come back to the Bay and gift us with some great art. So let's talk about Paul Robeson. You know, he was so accomplished, especially for his time, especially during just such a racially hostile time. He was the first black football player at Rutgers. He graduated top of his class. He earned a law degree from Ivy League, Columbia University. His father had been enslaved and then was free and became a preacher. I mean, so the fact that he was able to achieve so much during that time, why did you want to pay tribute to him this month?
Well, I can talk both in immediate terms and also historical terms. In immediate terms, 2 years ago, we were here or coming here, and a friend said, oh, you know, it's Paul Robeson's 125th. And so we said, okay, well, she insisted, you know, she really encouraged us to celebrate it, because also at Rutgers, they had done an outdoor installation to him. I think it was a statue or a bust. And then also there's a little courtyard or park in his honor. And so there was a lot of stuff coming up at his 125th. And so we did a 125th celebration out here. And then we decided to do it again this year because of the particular moment in history that we're in, you know, whereby all the cultural and other institutions are being attacked and demolished at warp speed, mm-hmm. and particularly institutions that reflect African American culture, like the African American Museum in DC, and then the MOAD in San Francisco is also being defunded in certain ways, and right. So we think it's very important at this particular time to uphold the strong resistance-oriented cultural figures and political figures, be that Harriet Tubman. Actually, I was one of the I was a poet on Harriet Tubman's centennial celebration in Auburn, New York, which was one of her. Yeah. Yeah, because it was that was 2013.
That's where she's buried, right?
That's where she's buried. You're mm-hmm. absolutely correct. And so I had the honor of being on that program. That was 2013, because they didn't have an accurate birth date for her, but they certainly had an accurate death date. That was 1913. So yeah, I was on that, and so and then going even further back. I was gifted a book on Robeson called Here I Stand way back in the 70s, and I still have it in my possession. Mm. And once I became aware of Robeson's incredible contributions, I mean, his contributions are lasting, everlasting, yeah. Because he set the tone for artists and culture workers, you know, like in other words, you have a gift and then your job is to put this gift in service of the people and the oppressed and downtrodden people worldwide, you know, right. Because, you know, you mentioned a number of factors, a number of accomplishments, achievements, and abilities that Robeson possessed. And I'll add another, which is he was a polyglot. You know, he was fluent in several languages, a multiplicity of languages, mm-hmm. and he could sing quite beautifully in those languages. In fact, he one time was in Russia, the Soviet Union, and there was some political points that he was not in agreement with. And so he sang, it was basically centered around anti-Semitism in a way. And he sang very beautifully the song of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And he sang it in Yiddish.
Oh, wow.
He could sing in Chinese.
Yeah, and I know he spoke Russian. I mean, he was really, you know, just a very brilliant man. And
totally.
Yeah, and I was, there's a great documentary that people can watch on YouTube that Lucasfilm produced about him. It's 30 minutes. Mentioned, too, how his, and Julia Malveau, who's from San Francisco, scholar, Dr. Julia Malveau, she's on that documentary. Shout out to her. Yeah, and they talked about how, you know, he was blacklisted because he said some things in Russia, because there was some issues going on in Russia, and he was, like, advocating for people that were oppressed, and so then they were making it seem like he was a communist, and he was blacklisted for, like, 8 years. He couldn't perform. The government took away his passport, so he couldn't travel. And his I think Dr. Julia Malveau said his wages went down from like $100,000 to like $6,000 a year.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's
so
correct.
Yeah, he you know, so he's really just a really interesting man. But I know, and unfortunately, because we were having some technical difficulties, so our interview is going to be cut a little short. But I want people to know, you know, what can they expect from this show? Because I saw some folks performing, and I know if you on the mic dropping poetry, you got me sold. Just
Thank
right
you.
There.
I appreciate it. Very kind of you. We're blessed to have Tammy Lynn Hall on piano. And we've been working with her for over 20 years now, it seems. And Roger Glenn on saxophone, and Kevin Goldberg on bass, Larry Van on drums, Ziggy Lowenberg,
nice.
Poetry, and myself, poetry. And what our program typically entails is we like to open up with Robeson's in his own words, you know, because we have some clips that were garnered by KPFA, the Pacifica Network, because that was one of his safe havens, you know, during the period when he was whitelisted by the fascist races. U.S. government, you know, particularly the Dixiecrats, who just despised him because, you know, he was, you know, quote unquote, an uppity black, you know, I mean, he wasn't coming in groveling, you know, they called him before the...
Yeah, that's why I said he was doing stuff during that time that's you know, pretty amazing. We got about 50 seconds, Mr. Turner, so...
Okay. Okay, so, yeah, what I would encourage people to do is to join us Saturday the 26th at 5 p.m. at the Plymouth Church of Jazz and Justice at 424 Monte Vista Avenue in Oakland. And we're calling it an emotional event. And we're using the occasion to celebrate Robeson's 127th birthday and its confluence with National Poetry Month and Jazz Appreciation Month.
Well, that sounds like an amazing event, and I hope people learn more about Paul Robeson and what he's done, and I hope people come and check you all out, because like I said, some great artists. Mr. Turner, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and oh my God, we've been having these technical difficulties all week long. So I don't know what's going on, you know, different medium.
Who knows? But you know, we're going to work it out, and we're working it out. That was poet Raymond Nat Turner. See him and
Thank
the rest
so
of
much.
The Upsurge Ensemble celebrate Paul Robeson's birthday this Saturday, April 26th. And it's all happening again at the Plymouth Jazz and Justice Church in Oakland. And next up, a film where a mysterious man pulls the mask off of city developers and leaders before they make a decision that could either save or harm their community. Stay with us. In the film The Masquerade, city leaders, developers, and community activists gather for a cocktail dinner party. They're discussing a plan to tear down the city's art district and replace it with a smart city. Now, one of the guests is a mysterious illusionist. He's played by former 49er tight end Vernon Davis. The illusionist magically causes the guests to tear off their mask and be open about the personal reasons backing their approval and disapproval on the high-tech development. And I'm being so dramatic as I'm reading this because of the music. But here to talk more about The Masquerade is Emmy-nominated filmmaker Jocelyn Rose Lyons. Hey, Jocelyn.
Hi, Janae. How are you?
Good. I was trying to put
it. It was so dramatic. Can I cast you in my next movie, Janae?
That's what I said. I was like, let me audition for Jocelyn.
You got the role. We're done.
You know, the music that my producer, Porfirio Rangel, chose, I was like, it goes great with the, you know, with the movie. So,
It's so cinematic.
Yeah, it is. It is. And congrats on the movie. I was just so wowed by it. So building smart cities, tearing down our spaces, you know, that's the theme that's in the movie, but that's real. That's real life. That's what a lot of us are dealing with. But where did the idea of this film come from, especially this character, Elias Bell, who's an illusionist? Like, that component was really interesting to me.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Thank you so much. And thank you again for having me.
Yes.
So Elias was, for me, you know, I have a very strong resonance with time. And as a filmmaker, I have different versions of my love letters to time kind of threaded throughout my pieces of work. And time is just a very interesting portal and also kind of character, if you will. So I wanted to create a character that would embody kind of the aspect of time that is not able to be personified. It's just kind of that vague, elusive presence in our day-to-day life. And so I created Elias Vail kind of because he thins the veil. I spell his name V-A-L-E as a character, Elias Vail, but it's kind of like the veil, V-E-I-L, that, you know, where you're essentially, he thins the veil between the realms of past, present, and future. And his presence, his mere presence alone in this piece kind of is symbolic of thinning that veil so that you can access the truth within your memories, your dreams, your hopes, and your fears, all within the same moment. And so I wanted to kind of create a character that would embody time from that perspective.
You know, and I was thinking too, you know, how so many people would love to have that gift, that magic to make, you know, politicians and, you know, just people that are very influential to drop their mask and to say what's really on their hearts, right? What's really, what they're really thinking. So that's what was interesting about it too, as well. So Vernon Davis, who plays the illusionist, is the film's executive producer. How did he get on board with this project?
Yeah, so Vernon Davis and I met on a film set called Off Season with George Kittle from the 49ers. He's the tight end for the 49ers and a prolific human being and athlete. As you all might know, in the Bay Area, he's definitely made his mark over the past few years with the 49ers. And me and Vernon were producing partners on that piece. I was directing. We're still in production on that series, docuseries. But we had just hit it off as creatives, and we started collaborating on a kind of a slew of nonfiction and scripted independent shorts and podcast style formats. And we just came together on this project like we have organically on several projects over the past few years, and just decided to team up and make something that was really meaningful. And I had this idea. I came to him with it, and he took the character right off the page and just brought it to life.
Oh, wow. Okay. And you all filmed this at the Claremont Hotel, right?
We did. We filmed it at a historic ballroom at the Claremont Hotel. And that ballroom was a space that I had toured at one point or another. And I just always felt like I wanted to film something in there. There was something about the walls in that particular ballroom that had some sort of history in them that just spoke to me. And so I could kind of just see the piece when I walked in the room. It just came to my mind, and then we shot it.
Okay. So it's filmed here in the Bay Area. So, you know, it's a cocktail dinner party. And so around the dinner table, there's the mayor, there's venture capitalists, there's an arts commissioner, there's an architect, some familiar faces of actors. actors. I see Ryan Nicole. Shout out to her and Don Lacey.
Shout out to Ryan. Yes, yeah. Don Lacey.
Yeah. So at this table, you know, it's just, and I was just thinking when I was looking at the table, I said, this is a small group of people who, and you know, and again, there's realism, there's reality in this fiction, but this is a small group of powerful people who make the decisions for the lives of thousands and millions of people. Was that your intent of using the dinner table? Because that's what hit me. Yes. I was like, it's not that many people, and they're making decisions that could cause people to be homeless, could cause people to be wealthy, you know.
That's a great, Janae, that is such a great take on it. And I didn't actually think of it in that particular, from that lens, but that is such a great point. And it's actually the truth around, I think, the way in which our city council, you know, it could be City X, any city across America. Right. We all have people that are decision makers and gatekeepers and just ultimately the people in position to green light demolition of a arts district or to green light, you know, the buildings that are going up around our communities, whether we like it or not. Technology is sometimes just introduced. They sometimes just add things to our communities, like electric bikes are just thrown onto every corner. No one asked if we want them there, but they're there. And so all that to say, yes, I think that it's important for us to remember that oftentimes the decisions that are made for our communities and for our cities are not necessarily reflective of our collective voice or individual perspectives. They're sometimes just based on the decision makers who are at those tables, so to speak. And if you have a seat at that table, then you have a voice in the room. If you don't, then you don't. You just have to hope and pray that, you know, there's someone in that room that's representing what you feel is the right thing for your city and your community. And if not, you got to go, I guess, fight for what you need.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that, and that's, you know, a good point, too, is like, you know, who's at the table that's fighting for you. And
right,
so some other people at the table are brothers. And this is also a story of brothers. So Jason is described as a man in the film that you describe as who's all about the blueprint and the bottom line. And he's part of the company that wants to tear down the arts district. And his brother Jared is the artist who's pushing it back against this proposal. And these brothers are estranged because they went two different, you know, ways of life. And it was interesting where they went two different routes. And it's interesting because Jason, you know, who wants to build this smart city and tear down the arts district, he benefited from the art district. You know, he grew up in that art district. He went to the after school programs there. And I was watching, I said, you know, it hurts when it's your own folks.
Right.
You know, you know, doing
right.
that, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. But yeah, I just, where the brothers too, just talk about that. Like, you know, as far as what do they represent for you in the film?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, without giving it away, because it is coming out on Apple TV, Amazon Prime, and VOD later this spring. So I don't want to give away the ending in case.
Oh, yeah, no, don't give away the ending.
Might want to watch this short film. But I will say what the brothers represent to me is that, you know, sometimes the people closest to you, you know, it could be your literal family, it could be your who you consider your friends or colleagues, aren't necessarily always going to be aligned. And that doesn't mean that they're wrong or you're right, or they're right and you're wrong. It just means that there is going to be differences within our own inner circle sometimes of what is best for our future, of our cities and our communities. And so my hope is that in this piece, we find that the only thing in the end that really matters is doing the right thing. Right. And that is bigger than family to some degree in this film. It's bigger than friendships. It's bigger than money. It's just what is your moral compass and how do you allow that to inform and inspire and guide your path ahead? And ultimately that one brother who was kind of going against the artist brother, is faced with that decision. Does he do what's right for his community and for his brotherhood and for his own city, or does he do what's right for what he thinks is the future of humanity in the context of technology and advancement. So he's faced with that decision in the end.
And something that, speaking of the right thing, something that you definitely did right in the film was interweaving dance sequences. I loved on, you know, when they would be on the stage, people who, as their masks, you know, these masks were coming off. And I'm saying that like symbolically. You know, and the truth serum was working, if you will, the truth magic.
And
you had the dancers, as these people were confessing their feelings, and the dance crew Turf Fiends is in there, and they performed at the Super Bowl with Kendrick Lamar recently. I really love how you put the dance in there. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, sometimes just like music, dance can, it just kind of pierces through the barriers of our mind. You know, there's a universal language when you listen to music and when you watch dance, when you see art. And because this movie is about the Arts District and its relevancy and its meaning and its impact in community, and I wanted to kind of underscore that feeling of how we can convey a message so powerfully through creativity. Mm-hmm. And so dance is its own language. And I wanted the brothers to communicate both with each other and within themselves through their dance. And so I use dance as kind of a symbolic way for them to get out of their own way and to be able to communicate physically with one another. And so that the language wasn't in the way, the words weren't getting in the way of what they were trying to convey to each other from an emotional place, from their heart. And to your point, when you take those masks off, I believe that these characters really embodied that when they were on that stage, Don Lacey and Omar Bolden and pretty much all of the actors that you saw, Ryan Nicole, Simone Lenora, everyone who got on that stage, Vernon Davis, and embodied that character without the mask on, that was their moment to kind of say, here I am in my essence. I'm not performing. I'm just being who I am on this stage by myself. And that's where the truth lives, ultimately. And in this film, my question really is, in the end, where does art live?
And it's also too, and as they're speaking, as again, as those masks are coming off, it sounds, those monologues were very poetic, Jocelyn. They were very poetic. Like you put some poetry in there.
Definitely some poetry. You know, Ryan Nicole and I go back almost 20 some years now. We first started together back when I was doing a lot of documentary and music television work, music videos, but I was working with a lot of poets, and Ryan was one of them, and she and I have stayed in touch for decades. She's a phenomenal poet, artist, activist, human being, friend, colleague. But yeah, I think I wanted their the language of their monologues on that stage to feel like stream of consciousness, and to some degree have a poetry to it, again, embodying the Arts District that the film is kind of about, and the relevancy and the impact of art, music, dance, poetry, like what is the value of this? And ultimately in this film, I think when the mask is off and people are speaking from their truth, that's when the art is most authentic, and that's when it resonates. And that's where I think the change really can happen. You know, you can spark more change from the truth than from, you know, fear, or from love versus fear. So I think when these characters, and they all did such beautiful work, when Simone Lenora, you know, broke out in tears in her monologue, you could just see that her character was breaking open for the light to get in. Like that crack was there so that her light could shine out into these moments and illuminate that path for these brothers to see the truth, you know.
It was so much in the film, and it wasn't overwhelming. I'm always impressed by artists who can have just, you know, a certain amount of time, and they put so many themes or messages in the film, and it doesn't overwhelm you. And there's a lot of little, and I know we're running a little on time, but there's a lot of little nuggets and quotes that are in the film too that have sat with me. So I really encourage people to check it out when it comes to Apple Plus and when it comes to Amazon Prime. Jocelyn, you have created and been a part of documentaries. Mm-hmm. This film is not a documentary, it's fiction. Which do you prefer to create as a filmmaker?
You know, it's a tough question. I came from documentary film. That was my first format. And then I have moved around different formats over the years. And right now I'm working on a couple of scripted projects, a couple feature films. So I'm really drawn to just messages that can ultimately just create light and spark change. And so it's really about the story that drives my interest in the rather than the format. I really am drawn to scripted. I think there's a lot of fun you can have with playing with time in scripted that's not as easily done in documentary, and character development that can be done in narrative work. So I think my my heart is probably in scripted storytelling because I think the imagination can really run free there. But I do love creating just stories that inspire and create change.
Well, Jocelyn, I look forward to seeing more of your work in the near future.
Thank you, Janae.
Definitely please come back when you have your next project.
I will. I would love to and be honored to. And thank you so much. Yes. I so appreciate, so grateful to be on your show.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking with director-filmmaker Jocelyn Rose Lyons. Her film, The Masquerade, comes out on Apple TV and Amazon Prime Video on May 20th. And that is all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner. They held it down. We were having some issues. I appreciate them so much. And our director of audio programming, thank you, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in and listening and hanging in there with us. And we'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Have you seen Sinners yet? Because maybe we'll have some folks to come on and talk about that and break down the movie. Of course, no spoilers. So go check it out in the meantime. So until then, be good to yourselves and each other. And one quick thing, I was talking to a family member who was feeling lonely, and I'm just encouraging people, call your folks, ask them to go out with you to a movie, ask you to go out to a show or a play. So, you know, connect with folks so folks don't have to be lonely. All right. All right. With that, next up is the Arts Hour from the BBC.